You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, digging deeper into the issues that make and break our lives. And our guest on this segment of the Made of Clay Report is Matt Bishop. Welcome, Matt.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
It's good to have you here this morning. The way we start the show is to ask, you know, who are you, which is kind of a huge question.
Both of my parents have spent a lot of their lives in New York City. So I'm someone who kind of can identify both with the culture and the people in the context of Ithaca, as well as the, you know, the ambition and the, energy and the pulse of New York City, which are very interesting, contrasting things. But some of the things that kind of shaped me the most were, I guess, my parents' values. I've always been told, or I've always felt that from those who much is given, much is expected. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I've kind of done my best to live my life by. And a lot of my life has been about, you know, exploration of how I can best make a difference, how I can, you know, what's my point, what's my role in quote, making a difference. And that much of my life has been a journey and kind of exploring what that is. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then the other big things are, I would say travel has greatly affected me and affected how I encounter and how I interact with people. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. When I was 10, I spent a year in England because my dad was on sabbatical, and we did a lot of traveling in Europe. And I think, you know, even though, you know, many of my friends were kind of like, you know, these English guys who, you know, looked a lot like me, so to speak, you know, to be exposed to the kind of cultural differences between different countries, and it helped create a kind of open-mindedness and a curiosity towards people of all different cultures and an interest in and wanting to learn more. Mm-hmm. And I think the other part is just, you know, I've always kind of I desired to be authentic and live real and true to myself. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Even if that clashes against expectations of professors or you know, friends or parents. And so authenticity is something I've sought in music and dance. Mm-hmm. and regular self-expression. Mm-hmm. So,
mm-hmm. Well, good. Well, that's the start. And we'll come back to all of those themes throughout the conversation, I imagine, because they will emerge and flesh themselves out as we go forward. Now, you brought some music with you, and we're going to start with Pharrell Williams' Happy. Okay. Do you want to say something before we play it, or do you want to say something after we've listened to it?
We'll say after.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. Very good. Here we go. It might seem crazy what I'm about to say.
That's what you want to do. Hey, go. Bring me down. Can't
And that was Pharrell Williams and Happy. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Matt Bishop. So, Matt, what are you happy about? Or why are you happy about Happy?
So, the song is very infectious. It's like, uh-huh, I can't really sit still when I'm listening to it. I always have this urge to kind of get up and dance.
Right.
And what I love, I also love the music video where, you know, it shows people of all different backgrounds just doing their own thing. Like, you know, just embracing their own authenticity and just dancing to their own groove. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I love how music can provide people with that opportunity for self-expression.
Right.
It's also kind of, it's been a, you know, when I have had, you know, rough times or when I've been upset about something, listening to that song has always put a smile on my face. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So
neat. When you use the term authenticity, what do you mean by that?
I guess it's important, we go through life and we interact with people and we interact with, you know, the media and friends and family, and it's important to understand, you know, what is it that I'm taking on, what kind of, whether it be behaviors or sayings or actions or attitudes or perspectives, what is it that I'm taking on because this is something I choose to take on, or mm-hmm, and what am I taking on that is just kind of that is not me, but mm-hmm, it's kind of like what others want to put on me, mm-hmm, others' view of the world. And so, you know, I think everybody has, you know, a certain sense of kind of self of both who they, what they identify, mm-hmm, with, and who they are and who they want to be.
Right.
Knowing that, like, they choose to take on, you know, perspectives or attitudes or forms of expression, that's their choice, and it's not something that's been kind of pushed on them by something that's expected by society or expected by,
right,
you know, friends or family.
Right. So you're choosing, you're the author of your own experience, exactly, or at least of your own, yeah, of your own, what you're projecting out to the world. It may not be understood as you intend it to be,
right,
but you are the one writing, you know, writing the, authoring your life. Yeah.
Yeah. Hillary, yeah, Clinton has a really great saying. She says, it's important to take feedback seriously, but not personally. Mm-hmm. So I think it's always important to listen to what other people have to say. Mm-hmm. And if I say something and it offends you, or you react to it strongly, mm-hmm, that I listen to whatever your feedback is and receive it as a, you know, as a respectful human being, one person to another.
Right.
But to not necessarily have to own someone else's experience of who I am.
Right. Or even own their experience of something you did.
Right.
Yeah. Because it's their experience, and you may have done something entirely different.
Right.
Not just as a matter of intent, but just what you were doing.
Right.
You used authenticity initially in terms of music and dance and these mm-hmm, very creative individual things. And did you mean it to be separate from our more corporate life, or did you, because that's kind of, that struck me.
And, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I've tended to, you know, excel at, you know, at math and a lot of, you know, quantitative things. You know, I taught myself to code. But there's a creative side of me that, you know, I've started to recognize more and more, and, you know, in the last maybe 5 to 10 years of my life, mm-hmm, you know, I'm 32 to get some perspective.
So since college, or
since
grad
college,
school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I've always, or I mean, even, even in college a little bit, you know, I enjoyed dancing since I was in high school. Since my senior year of high school, but I just recently started taking a hip hop dance class.
Uh-huh.
And if you saw me on the street, you probably wouldn't peg me as that guy does hip hop dance. So I love being the counter stereotype. When I was in Spain, my friends used to say blanquito, you know, uh-huh, little, uh-huh, white, which is like an affection term for white boy. you know,
yep.
So, you know, So I like to kind of be kind of the stereotypes. But I find dance is oftentimes the ultimate, you know, for me, it can be a very, almost an ultimate form of self-expression because, mm-hmm. You know, you're only limited by your imagination and what you imagine you can do and what your body is expressing to the music. So
right.
I think, you know, to either see other people live in their own kind of mm-hmm. groove and mm-hmm. or and just to be able to express my own is important to me.
Right. And you used a term in terms of the hip hop as kind of going against this. You like to, you know, go against the stereotype or flip it. One of the things about authenticity is always a tension between knowing how to be in conversation or collaboration with the structures around us or just in opposition. And it's an interesting and too much conformity takes away the depth in the conversation, and too much opposition takes away other stuff.
Right.
It's an interesting balance, and it was played out in your choice of words, it felt like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that's happened as I've, you know, gotten older, and some people will laugh at 32-year-old talking about
right.
getting
yeah,
older,
yeah, 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 yeah.
But, you know, is I've kind of acquired a lot more humility, and, you know, I used to feel like I knew what I had to do to make a difference, to change the world.
Mm-hmm.
And now today I feel a lot more humble about the challenges of making change and you know, knowing exactly what my best role is and my best way of having an impact. That, you know, issues of whether it be social issues, you know, like issues, you know, the violence, the police brutality in the Eric Garner case, and or whether it be working in government, or whether it be, you know, this whole social enterprise sector that's, you know, trying to combine right. nonprofits. It's there's so many different kind of points of leverage, and the issues are a lot more complicated than we think.
Right, and I think, you know, the one of the. I think it was Maimonides, I may be wrong on this, said that you shouldn't study the more mystical dimensions of life until you're 40 years old with a family. Because prior to that, you haven't been humbled to the point where, and frayed to the point where you can understand and hold these things that are paradoxical or hypocritical or contrary. And you know, that's a part of what I hear in your story. What experience made you have to stop charging quite so hard for change, and what was it? What were the issues? Some of the issues that you cared about and were working on.
There are a few that stand out. One of the defining issues in my life has been healthcare reform.
Mm-hmm.
You know, healthcare and. You know, after my mom was diagnosed with cancer, breast cancer for the second time, you know, the first time I was very young.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, you know, I didn't fully understand it. I was maybe 8 years old, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And the second time I was actually on a date when I heard the news. I was going bowling.
You got a phone call or a text message?
I got a phone call.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was going up the elevator and I was like, oh, that's strange. But we usually talk to my mom, you know, on the weekends mm-hmm. and... Mm-hmm. And she told me, and I just, you know, you just feel so helpless, right? Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. when someone's mm-hmm. sick, you feel like there's nothing you can do. You can try to make sure that they get the best healthcare and just pray.
Right.
And you can try to spend time with them. So I did my best to come home. And you know, thank God, she is cancer free today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because she has always had the best health insurance. She worked as a principal of a middle school. She had a great health insurance, and so we caught it early. And she's, you know, thanks God, she's cancer free today. But right at the time, we were having a national conversation about healthcare.
Right.
And so I started doing community organizing around healthcare reform. I was organizing the Young Democrats. And I was eventually organizing the Young Democrats statewide on this issue, and we were part of a national coalition called the Healthcare for America Now Coalition.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I realized that at first I was trying to do everything myself. I was trying to, you know, get the work done myself, make the phone calls myself, do this, do that.
Right.
And I quickly learned that, you know, the role of an organizer and the role of a leader is to not just to recruit others to your cause, but also to build other leaders, mm-hmm. you know, especially when you're working in a statewide capacity. So I think that was my first, you know, kind of experience by running into my own limitations. My limitations that you can't always do all the work yourself. You need to build team and build other leaders. So I think that was one. I think also, you know, I have a business that helps nonprofits and small businesses with social media strategy and crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. And I think that the vision was always, it started out by focusing on charitable giving.
Right.
And focusing on wanting to leverage social media to create a more generous world. That mm-hmm. the idea was that every donation should be an inspiration to give more.
Right.
And that through social media, that donation could be shared and inspire others to give.
Right, right. So you would, if I understand correctly, when somebody gives to a cause, then in their social media network, people are notified that that gift has been made, and they're more likely to look at that cause favorably and give themselves.
Right. I mean, that was the basic idea was that mm-hmm. you know, social media, an idea could spread online mm-hmm. faster and inspire others to give. And I think there's, you know, I think the challenges associated with creating a business and, you know, building a technology company mm-hmm. Lessons that I've learned. There have been many lessons I've learned from doing that have taught me my own limitations.
Right, right. And I'm wondering, with that particular model, are people willing to share where they're giving with their friends, or is people reluctant to do that? Is that, because that would seem to be the first question.
Yeah. Yeah. So people are willing to share with, like, it's definitely, that is definitely something that people are willing to do. You've seen this kind of, this movement that started with a lot of, you know, everybody's, usually, like, they've had a friend who's done like a run or a walk, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. or they're raising money for a cause that they care about, and you know, so this has always kind of happened in a person-to-person basis of mm-hmm. one person coming to another saying, "Hey, would you be willing to give money to this cause? You know, it's something that matters to me because of X, Y, or Z."
Right.
And what online has done is it's been able to bring this experience mm-hmm. that's already been happening in the face-to-face level,
right,
and it's been brought it online. So now I think about 8 or 10% of money, all the $300 billion that is given or for charity is raised online. So it's mm-hmm. it's not a large proportion of the total amount given, but it's something that's growing,
right?
And I think that the challenge which I discovered is that it's not, you know, you can give somebody a technology that helps people, inspire people to give,
right.
But there's something that's fundamental about the way that ask happens, mm-hmm. the story of behind the cause mm-hmm. that is so fundamental to the success of a campaign that it doesn't matter if you have the best technology in the world, if you don't have the story that drives the messaging behind the organization, right. You're not going to raise a lot of money.
So in the initial posing of this, what I heard was people will just know what their friends are giving to, but now it's not just know, you want their friends to share a particular story about why they're giving.
Right.
And that's proven more important and more difficult, if I'm hearing correctly.
Right. So people will, to some extent, people will give because they're asked by their friend. Oftentimes people will give because they're asked by their friend. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But for something to truly go viral, to have a global effect, to really kind of reach a level of scale that you know, we seek with online fundraising, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It really needs to have a powerful story behind it. It's what I call the oldest technology in the world. It's something that goes back before mm-hmm. You know, the internet. And I think that the components of what, you know, a good story. And so I spent a lot of time recently trying to understand what is it about, you know, stories that inspire people and motivate people to be part of something larger than themselves.
Mm-hmm. And there's a difference, though, between inspiring people to take action versus inspiring to give money. and how does that play out? Yeah,
right.
How do you find what's significant about that difference in terms of how you get people to seek raising money for their causes?
There's two different ways of answering the question. Sure. So the first way is that one, you're absolutely right that one needs to know who you're speaking to, who's mm-hmm. your audience, because not everybody has the capacity to give to mm-hmm. a cause. And you know, what is the thing that you want them to do? What is the call to action, mm-hmm. so to speak, that is most important? And that's going to change the context of your story, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
The reason I've focused on charitable giving in the past is because it's something that's very measurable and tangible, and it's easy to be able to say, okay, this was the impact of, you know, this campaign or, you know, this right. platform or this whatever. And so I think it's something that's very measurable. So there's
and the countless... number cruncher in you is fed by that.
Yes, yes. Exactly. Yes. So I think there are, you know, all sorts of ways that people are making a difference and impacting the world, giving is absolutely just one of them. You know, the way that people volunteer, the hours that they give to helping volunteer or advising a charity as it grows, or right. There's all sorts of ways people can contribute that. And from a storytelling perspective, it's usually best to have one call to action, right. because if you provide multiple calls to action, oftentimes people get confused and they're not sure what they have, mm-hmm. what mm-hmm. they're supposed to
not
do.
Not sure what they're doing. Yeah. 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 No, those all make sense. We're going to come back to some of these themes, but let's cut to music. Shall we go to Dancing on My Own?
Sure.
And again, do you want to talk about it now or talk about it?
Sure. I'll talk now. So I think again, Dancing on My Own is again, just as I was saying about dance, it's a song that is very, like, it makes me want to dance. And I'm, you know, I've oftentimes even been that one person in a, you know, in a bar or in a party, and I'm the only one dancing at first, and then uh-huh. maybe other people come on and start dancing. But, you know, it's also about, I think, just to me, it's about being willing to go out on your own and do your own thing and being authentic. It goes back to the idea of being authentic.
Yes, so. Yes. It's Robin with Dancing on My Own. Somebody said you got a new friend. Does she love you better than I can? And that was Robin and Dancing on My Own. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Matt Bishop. Matt, you had used a term in the opening, your opening comments. One of the things that kind of pervaded the atmosphere of your growing up was the idea that, you know, to those whom much has been given, much is expected.
Mm-hmm.
And I associate that with the term it's an expectation of gratitude that we have in this country and in certain sectors, but it's also rooted in a European notion of noblesse oblige. And it's the obligation of those who have great resources to use them for for the nobility. It was a requirement that the nobility serve as some justification of what they had. And there's a tension. There's a real tension because I too am a person who is very committed to trying to bring into existence the world that I believe it ought to be, and to deal with it as much as it is, and that's overwhelming and humbling. And I've been given a lot. I've been given the opportunity to get essentially 3 degrees, an undergraduate degree and 2 graduate degrees at no expense, except my time, because of right. scholarships and funding, and some of them based on my poverty and some of them based on my skills. And not having debt has meant I can do things with my life that other people couldn't do if they were saddled with $50,000 or $100,000 of debt coming out of programs. But it's also makes me question, who am I to decide what to do? You know what I'm saying? And there's a humbling aspect to that. Mm. And I also was relating to your talking about how and wondering if there was a connection when you have experienced the gift of having received a lot. Sometimes I felt like I've tried too hard to do a lot. And it took me a while to be able to not feel like I had to manage the whole program and to be on top of all the pieces, rather than just to cut it loose to people to do with as they would, or to take it on and redefine it in ways that they wanted to. And it wasn't so much that I wanted the control, but it was that I was unable to let go of the obligation to do what I needed to do. You know.
So two friends of mine have at very important points just kind of reminded me of this, or so one, it was completely strange. We were just at a bar, not having any kind of profound conversation.
Sure.
And she turns to me and says, "Matt, you can't save everybody." Right. And I was just kind of befuddled, and I was like, how did you know I needed to hear that? And then another one, ex-girlfriend of mine, asked me, "What makes you think that people need saving?" Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's taken some time for me to, I think, again, this comes from the humility we were speaking about earlier, to question my original paths and sense of, maybe a little bit too much self-righteousness, because I was on this journey to make a difference or save the world or whatever, whatever it might be. And then realizing, being like, well, what is my responsibility? And I don't think I fully answered that question. Mm-hmm. I think, my family was just having this conversation on Christmas. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. About Christmas is a good time for this kind of reflection.
To be talking about giving and to be talking about, how we give and to whom do we give. Uh-huh. And what would it be like if we never said no, if we just said, and if we always gave something. Because sometimes we have a mindset in my family of being very analytical and quantitative, and we want to measure the impact of the, what is the charity's effectiveness in reaching its mission, and what percentage of the money are you give it of what you're giving is going to go to the actual program. And we get caught up in all these ideas that we sometimes miss some of the larger picture the benefits of the person who's giving. But to go back to what I was saying earlier, I feel a lot less certain about me feeling like I know I have the answer to these questions today than I did 3 years ago or 7 years ago.
Right. I think, where did the conversation go about never saying no? Because that's a really, really significant teaching text in a lot of traditions.
So the way what I brought it back to in the conversation, my brother was saying that, what if we never said no, and that it's not just about giving money, but it's about giving your time, mm-hmm. giving of yourself, of assisting people who need help with a move or something. But what I brought it back to is that we have a certain amount of bandwidth, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. it's both, we have a certain amount of monetary bandwidth and time bandwidth and emotional, mm-hmm. psychological bandwidth. And so, faith has always been something important in my life. Mm-hmm. And in, you know, the Bible, in the Bible, Jesus says, you know, look at the birds and the flowers, you know, we provide for them. Right. You know, again and again, there is this message throughout many, many, many sacred texts that, you know, those who give now, those who are generous will, mm-hmm. will receive more in the afterlife, or will, they'll get more. And that was something that my mom was echoing, that she feels like she's received so much more and she's been blessed so much more. And she's, it's meant a lot for her to give back to the mm-hmm. community. So so I think what I drew back to was that in order to be able to give, be giving and generous in every, you know, in each of those moments, even when we feel like we have to, we have little bandwidth, whether it's psychological or financial, where we don't feel like we may not feel like we're most full and we're most ready to do it, mm-hmm. that we need to be grounded in that, in faith in something, right? In faith that, that we are going to be okay, that we right, are going to right. be all right, and that I'm not going to be worse off, that you have to have that grounding of faith in order to continue and have that bandwidth to right. continue to give.
Right. I think, and what you're not quite saying, I think, let me just do the station ID. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and Matt Bishop is our guest on this hour. One of the things that I think you're backing up against is the idea that giving is done from excess or abundance. And if we don't feel like we have extra to give, or if we don't feel like we can let go of something, then we want to hold it. So we have to find a way to let it go and feel good about it. And for many people, that is the faith or the confidence, the hope and trust, which is the traditional definition of faith, that it'll work out. So you give something that may, and I think, and that's a particularly poignant backdrop in a consumer culture, because we don't want to, you know, we don't want to give if it would compromise ourselves. But almost all of the spiritual practices around giving
yes.
That really work compromise the people who make the gifts.
Yes.
And when they're compromised, they actually discover more about themselves. And what they're capable of that they wouldn't have discovered had they not chosen to compromise themselves in making the gift. And that's a powerful lesson. And the other piece that you were saying, which is where I wondered where you might take it in terms of where, you know, never saying no. What happens is that when you never say no, when you always have to find something to say yes to, you have to figure out what your relationship is to the person who's asking.
Yes.
And then over time, the person who's asking, assuming this is an individual, in the texts that talk about never saying no, they're individuals asking for help, not organizations. So this is where corporate persons don't apply. So when individuals ask, you never say no, but you have to find out, how can I say yes with integrity? You mm-hmm. can't give what you don't have. Mm-hmm. Also, the other thing is if a person can trust that you will give them what they ask for, then they quit asking for stuff they don't need eventually, if they can really trust that, because a lot of people don't know how to ask because they don't trust that they'll ever get what it is they really need. You know what I mean? And that puts the power on the other side. A lot of these teachings about giving to anyone who asks is turning the power of the giver over to the one who's asking. And letting them control the relationship more than is usually done with charity, because mm-hmm. charity is a hard hierarchical relationship to be involved in.
And that's one of the, you know, the kind of I guess doubts or one of the questions I still have is
sure.
that, you know, I am initially my focus on philanthropy was that you could approach every organization that you're working with and try to judge individually, you know, is this an organization that fits into the mission of, you know, having giving back or having some kind mm-hmm. of social impact or larger you know, goal towards bettering the society that they are.
Right.
But if you want to do that on scale, that's going to end up taking time. That's going to take, it's going to take a lot of time to, you know, working with each organization that you're, you know, whether it be a business or a charity. So I said, I'm going to just focus on, you know, charitable giving because, I'm going to basically outsource
individual charitable giving.
Individual charitable giving, right?
Yeah.
I'm just going to focus on that because, you know, I'm going to outsource the responsibility of determining what is a good cause to the IRS, essentially, because the IRS is what determines that designates people as charities.
Or to use the logic of your system to what people have chosen to give into, to give to, and let their friends know.
But you know, because sorting out, you know, is this organization that's not a charity, but it's a person or this or that, like that, I just said, oh, I don't want to have to deal with answering that question each time. And I later, you know, realized that there's a lot of, you know, startups and businesses and other organizations that are facing similar challenges of wanting to use social media, wanting to raise money through what we call crowdfunding, which is raising money for not necessarily a charity, but, you know,
a business startup or a cause
or an organization. And so that there are a lot of organizations that are facing the same challenges, and so that I could help them too.
Yeah. So your business is expanding.
Yes.
In focus.
Yeah.
Cool. So it sounds like you've had to change some of your commitments, or you've had to become suspicious of where you started. And one of the questions that I often ask is, you know, what have you learned that has forced you to change a deeply held commitment? What experience has made you suspicious of what you once thought was just a no-brainer is true?
So I went through most of my life thinking that that you know, politics and government and, you know, that was kind of like my highest calling, and that I should run for office someday, and I should become an elected official, and that was the way I was gonna.
And you ran for office.
I did. I ran for county legislature, and I lost by a few dozen votes
to Nate Shinagawa,
who's doing a good job as far as I know. Uh-huh. I haven't been following his exploits, but I think that didn't really dissuade me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I continued in that path for a number of years. For about 4 years, you know, I worked in government. I worked in a state hospital when I moved to New York City. Right. Worked in a nonprofit organization, was still with the intention to run for office someday. But it took an experience of really meeting a woman on a subway that, and really a spiritual experience that made me reassess my commitments on how I can best make a difference.
So what happened?
So, I was actually going to a soccer game. I was on the 7 train in New York City going into Queens, and I met a woman named Maricela. She was a Brazilian immigrant working in Manhattan, working as a housekeeper, working to provide for her 5-year-old daughter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and somehow. Actually, she was reading the Bible when I saw her, and I managed to speak to her in Spanish. She spoke Spanish, even though she was from Brazil,
where they speak
Portuguese. We started talking, and somehow we get into this deep conversation, and I asked her, if you could have anything in life, what would it be? And she said, you know, I wish I had gotten more education when I was younger, but all I care about is creating a better future for my daughter. In fact, her first answer was, you know, I'd have more love in my life, because when you have more love, you have more of everything.
Uh-huh.
And so I was really floored, you know. Uh-huh. I was really floored because, you know, I was expecting her to respond about something, you know, material, you know, I wish I had more money to, you know, pay for food or rent or whatever it might be. But she talked about, first of all, about this desire to have more love in her life, and secondly, about she had this vision for her daughter that is much like millions and billions of people around the world, this desire to create a better future. And so I felt that, you know, we were, in some ways, we're all the same, that we all want to create a better future for our children. And that if everybody was a little bit more generous, then we could create a better future for her daughter and for millions of other people just like her.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, she got off the train, and I've never seen her again, but I was at home that night and was going through my closet and I started finding all this clothing. I was like, well, I don't need this. I'm going to give this away. I'm going to start this giveaway pile. And then I went to my bookshelf and I'm like, I've read most of these books, so I'm going to start giving these away. And then I went to my kitchen and I was like, oh, you know, I only use 4 pots and pans, if that. So I'm going to start giving pots and pans away. And everywhere I looked around, I was like, I was seeing stuff that I didn't need. And so there was this huge pile of stuff that I just ended up kind of giving away. And at that point, I just kind of broke, you know, I realized that even though I never lived an extravagant lifestyle, that I accumulated all this stuff that I didn't need. And that in order to change the world, in order to change people's, I had to first change people's minds about what their role in the world was.
And you had to change your own behavior.
And I had to change my own behavior too.
Yeah.
And so I saw politics partly as, you know, something where there's kind of like this incremental gain.
Mm-hmm.
There's an incremental back and forth. You know, Democrats are up. They pass some things that are good and maybe some things that are bad. And then the Republicans are up and they control things and they pass things that are good and some things that are bad. And so that I saw that there wasn't the kind of systematic, you know, change that needed to be happening, and that in order for that change to need to happen, the people's ideas about their roles in the world and about giving could be that change.
Right.
Across religion and culture and political party, there is a tradition of giving, and that's something that could cut across lines.
Right. But I guess what I'm hearing is that's running up against the political reality that all politics does is redistribute goods and services. And what you're asking for is for people to be allies in each other's lives. And there's no public, there's no political policy that can do that. You're calling for, in some sense, a cultural change or a social change that transcends politics. It could inform politics, but it transcends politics.
I think, like, you know, you're nailing it on the head, that, you know, I think looking back on my experience after creating my business and, you know, taking the path I did, the one thing this journey has, you know, done is inspired me about the potential and the limitations of technology. You know, I'm very optimistic and excited about how technology can make people's lives easier and create wealth and solve problems. But there is this cultural element which remains that I think you're
taught.
And I don't have the answers to in terms of how to address it, because, you know, I've been involved in progressive politics for some time, including organizations that are advocating for after school programs for kids, universal health care, universal pre-K, getting corporate money out of elections. But all these things end up being in a us versus them kind of mentality.
It's because it has become an issue of the delivery of the goods, and then who can fight who about what goods should be delivered. Let's cut to some music. Can we cut to The Dog Days Are Over? And then we'll continue with some of these themes before we're done.
Happiness hit her like a train on a track. Coming towards her, stuck still, no turning back. She hit around corners and she hid under. Washed it away down the kitchen.
And that was Florence and the Machine and the Dog Days Are Over. And our guest on this hour is Matt Bishop. So, Matt, you have you've tried to find an angle into increasing the ability of people to be generous with others.
Yeah.
And charitable donations was one form, but also just getting people. But your efforts to date have pretty much tied you to working, to trying to support or fund organizations or causes.
Right.
And I'm wondering if the goal that you started out with of making people more generous to each other has gotten displaced onto organizations. It's a standard sociological phenomenon that the things we set out to do with specific people in mind, we get generalized, and then the institution and serving the organization or whatever becomes the more paramount, the more important thing, and we lose the initial motivation and the core focus of the people. Mm-hmm. How do you maintain those two things as you try to walk your business forward?
Right. So, you know, I think I remain focused. I remain committed. Committed to the goal of motivating people to give and to creating a more generous world. At the same time, I for the first time I've had questions whether is it philanthropic giving that is going to be mm-hmm. The driver in truly transforming this world, making the world a better place. Right. There are incredibly amazing technologies that are changing the world and improving people's health.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I guess I won't go into all the details. I mean, there's technologies that basically would include like 20 to 50 tests in like one lab. So you basically take one sample of mm-hmm. blood and then like you can run 100 tests on it mm-hmm. immediately. There is mobile technologies. I have a cell phone. We all have cell phones. Teenagers have cell phones today mm-hmm. that are more powerful than the president had 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I think it's amazing how technology, I'm thinking more and more that it's going to be really government and the philanthropic sector working in partnership, empowered by technologies, that is going to truly make the difference. But I think the largest driver is going to be technology and making a difference in the world. And to get back to what you were saying about the cultural change and the cultural change we need, to me, that's a bigger question mark on how to accomplish that,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I guess what my question came out of, it was a Brazilian woman raising a 5-year-old daughter on her own that affected you, not giving, not your giving anything. It was her
story,
her life. And my guess is that the demand side of what's needed is missing, because the technology side is on the production side, but the demand side is what we don't know how to relate to what other people perceive they need. And when we know that, we can then begin to meet it in the terms that they ask for it. And that creates a long-lasting bond. And there seems to be a disconnect in our philanthropic world between the genuine needs of people and the way those needs are packaged by nonprofit organizations or by Sure. technology dealers. And I would think there would be a tremendous opening for your work in terms of articulating, putting people into relationships where they are interacting with people who could benefit perhaps from their technology, or they could invent different technology that would really speak to what that person needs, because that seems to be the missing picture in making the transition. And it also takes away some of the dependency issues around charity and creates markets, because those people have needs and demands.
Absolutely. So I think use the different language, the language sure. that entrepreneurs do. Uh-huh. It has to, what we talk about is being customer-centric product, or a product that really seeks to solve the problems of the people that you're trying mm-hmm. to serve. And there's, you know,
yeah.
I'm not sure if is that what you're
getting at it, but not quite. Yeah. When you're customer-centered, I define the customer that I am centered on, and I am willing to do this, and I'm willing to do it in this right. way. If you have reached a level of respecting human beings as your absolute equal,
yes.
then I will listen to what anyone has to say to me, and I will try to find what's there and how I can make a difference for the good in their life based on what I have.
Right.
And that's not customer-centered. That is treating human beings as having needs and desires and aspirations that are equal to my own. And if I'm going to honor my own, I'm going to honor theirs. So it's more of a radical equality.
Customer might sound as like a bad word.
It's not a bad word. It's not a bad word, but it's a role.
It's
a role. And I as an entrepreneur, I define the customers I want to serve. And that puts me in control in a hierarchical relationship. Even if I'm trying to serve the customer, it's still putting me in control. I may end up killing the business that I set up, or stopping the business that I set up and starting something else when I really start listening to other people, like the Brazilian woman on the subway.
Right.
Those things are powerful, and you seem to be able to have a foot in both worlds, but they haven't connected.
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying. What you mean by they're not connected?
They're not connected with the power of this, of the side of the Brazilian woman in the subway, and the power of the knowledge of organizations and technology on the other right. side. That I'm cheering you along to make the connection, because I think you can.
So yeah, I think a lot of organizations, this is something that a lot of organizations struggle with. I think the inspiration of the story, it was not, I didn't mean it quite literally that I was going to solve this Brazilian woman's problems, you know, and her child's problems. You know, I don't know exactly what, you know, I spoke to her just for a few minutes, so I don't really know what the real struggles were, but it was more, her story was an inspiration for me to...
It opened you up.
It opened me up to right. to wanting to thinking that philanthropy might play a role in making an impact. And so I don't, there are really interesting organizations. There's an organization called Significance Labs, and what they look to do is to go look at the people who are living in poverty, and they're based in New York City. Uh-huh. And then they take entrepreneurs that have been building technological products at, you know, Facebook and Google and whatever, and they say, they put them in touch with these communities, mm-hmm. and they say, oh, and just like people, you kind of like live in experience and communication mm-hmm. with these people mm-hmm. to really fully understand what the problems they're struggling with are, instead of making assumptions about, okay, right. you know, I'm, you know, here I am. I'm some entrepreneur. I assume that I understand what your problems are, your struggles are,
right.
but that's really going there and really understanding it from the end user. Again, I'm right. talking technology
yeah,
speak.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
the end
yeah,
user's
yeah,
perspective.
Yeah, yeah. And
the people
and,
who had used the technology,
right.
so to speak.
And if they were to take the model that I was talking about, they would bring the people from where they live into their own spaces, and those people would say, why are you doing it this way? Because that's a waste of resources. Or, you know, because people who live very modestly oftentimes know how to do things more effectively than people who have more than they need.
Yeah.
And so that's when you cross the side in both directions, there's a chance for profound learning, which takes it out of kind of a consumer or market driven model and puts it more in an ongoing relational model. That may be more my issue than yours, but that's one of the things that I see pushing up behind what you care about, which is, I mean, good stuff all the way around, but and difficult questions. Just what do you do? You have been at this for 10 years in terms of being casting about for where you're going to take your philanthropic or other political ambitions. What do you do on a daily basis, weekly basis, monthly basis, yearly basis to sustain yourself emotionally, intellectually, physically? What do you do to kind of reground yourself?
Well, I have great family and friends that are those there for me to, you know, for conversation or to support me whenever I need it. I take a hip hop dance class, which I already mentioned. Mm-hmm. It's 3 hours sure. every Friday. And that is kind of like an outlet and a form of self-expression. Mm-hmm. And,
yep.
And then I go to church as often as I can, or maybe I need to go more often. But you know, it's a form, I think it's a place. Church is a place of remembrance for mm-hmm. me, of reminding me of my faith. And I pray, daily.
And what does it mean to you to pray?
It means to be, you know, in communion with God, with a higher power. I probably do more talking than I do listening, and mm-hmm. probably the same problem I have in real life. In my non-prayer life, I should say.
Right. Prayer is a mix of speaking and listening for a lot of people. It's meditation. It's words. It's not words. Yeah. Yeah. But for you, it's words mostly. Conversation.
I think looking to the ways that God communicates with us and whether it be in silence or in, you know, in encounters with other people mm-hmm. and finding that is important too.
How does the prayer that you do daily, how does that make a difference in your life?
I'm not sure how to answer that question, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. We tend to do things that matter, and things that matter tend to make a difference. So maybe let me frame the question differently. How does it why does it matter to you that you pray daily?
I pray most days. It's not mm-hmm. like there's not like a specific time or anything.
It's an important part of your life.
You know, I think again, it matters because, you know, I believe in truth. I don't think that everything is just perfectly relative. There is no real, you know, best way to have an impact or to live. And so I think it to me it matters because I'm oftentimes asking for the guidance on what I need to focus on mm-hmm, a day-to-day mm-hmm. basis. And as an entrepreneur, that's one of your greatest challenges because, you know, when you have a small team, you have multiple responsibilities, you have multiple hats. You mm-hmm, have, mm-hmm. you know, the hat of filing, you know, your taxes or responding to regulations. You have the hats of going out and finding customers, of working on projects of existing customers, you know, of building technologies. So there's so many different hats, and knowing what to focus on is challenging.
And so prayer focuses what your activities, when they could pull you in too many different directions and you'd lose sight of what really mattered or what you were trying to do.
Yeah.
Neat. Matt, it's been good to get to know you a bit on the show. And we're going to cut to our last song. And I think you wanted that to be Cause by Sixta Rodriguez.
Yeah.
Do you want to say something about that now?
Yeah. So I was exposed to this song during a movie called Searching for Sugar Man. And it's a beautiful movie about a famous musician who rose to popularity in South Africa during apartheid. Mm-hmm. And it's about the search to find where this musician is, because he seemed to kind of drop off mm-hmm. off the earth. But what struck me about this song is that it's just so sad and tragic.
Mm-hmm.
And the words are so poetic. They're poetic and profound and kind of, you know, almost ironic in some mm-hmm. way. So you can't help but feel compassion for this guy.
Okay. So Rodriguez and Cause.
Cause I lost my job 2 weeks before Christmas. And I talked to Jesus at the sewer, and the Pope said it was none of his goddamn business. While the rain drank champagne, my Estonian archangel came and got me wasted. Cause the sweetest kiss I ever got is the one I've never tasted. Oh, but they'll take their bonus pay to Molly McDonald. Neon lady, beauty's that which obeys, is bought or borrowed. Cause my heart's become a crooked hotel, full of rumors. But it's I who pays the rent for these fingered face out of tuners. And I make 16 solid half-hour friendships every evening. Cause your queen of hearts, who's half a stone and likes to laugh alone, is always threatening you with leaving. Oh, but they'll play those token games on Willie Thompson and give a medal to replace the sun of Mrs. Annie Johnson. Cause they told me everybody's gotta pay their dues, and I explained that I had overpaid them. So overdue, I went to the company store, and the clerk there said that they had just been invaded. So I set sail in a teardrop and escape beneath the door sill. Cause the smell of her perfume echoes in my head still. Cause I see my people trying to drown the sun in weekends of whiskey sours. Cause how many times can you wake up in this comic book and plant flowers?